Judges chapter 17 is perhaps a more obscure passage, these two chapters. Its obscurity, one of my lasting memories from this chapter is from being in seminary and was second year Hebrew class, and we were having a translation test, and it's a time test where you walk in the classroom and the professor says, "Open your Hebrew Bible to such and such a passage and begin translating." And it was open to Judges 17. Not a passage that you're real familiar with. But I want us to, this morning, from there's a real message here in what seems to be an obscure passage from the Old Testament. We've been making our way through Judges, and in the first 16 chapters of the book of Judges, we've seen the people of Israel go through this downward spiral over and over again through this cycle of sinfulness, God then delivering them into the hands of their enemies and the oppression, the servitude to their enemies. Then they would cry out to the Lord, and the Lord would raise up a judge, and the judge would deliver them, and then there'd be a period of peace and rest, and then the cycle would be repeated as they would once again go into sin. And we began to get the feeling after this cycle repetitively and the number of judges we've been through that no matter how often God warned them, no matter how many miraculous interventions he made on their behalf, or no matter how many times they got defeated and were oppressed, yet they're still not learning the lesson that what God wants is wholehearted obedience to him. In those first 16 chapters, the focus was upon the deliverers whom God raised up. And we looked at those major judges, Othniel, Ehud, Deborah, Gideon, Jephthah, and Samson. That section of the book dealt with a series of external threats, that is, external threats as foreign enemies seeking to bring them into subjection. So it was a focus upon the external threats to Israel's existence. These final five chapters focus on the internal threat. You hear people say, you know, Rome fell because of the corruption within. A lot of people comparing America to Rome now. It's going to fall because of the corruption from within. Well, the focus in these five chapters is the internal corruption. The internal corruption, not the external. The previous chapters only gave us sort of an overview, bird's eye view of the sinfulness of Israel. In passing, it would say, and we saw this phrase repeatedly, twice in chapter 3, once in chapter 4, once in chapter 6, once in chapter 10, and once in chapter 13, generally at the beginning of each judge. The phrase, "the people did evil again in the eyes of the Lord." A general overview statement. Now here in chapter 5, we're going to get a ground level feel of what that doing evil in the sight of the Lord looks like, both spiritually, religiously, as well as morally. So we're going to, not the broad stroke passing overview of they did evil. Now we're going to step right down on the ground level and see what this evil looks like. And it's not going to be pretty, particularly next week as we look at the moral corruption. The early chapters, the focus was upon God rescuing the people of Israel. These five chapters, the focus is going to be, what is he rescuing them from? What is the sinfulness he's trying to deliver them from? And we're going to see it again in detail in these two episodes here in these final five chapters. The first episode of Micah and the Danites, and that's what we're looking at today, chapter 17 and 18, pictures for us the spiritual and the religious corruption of a day that Judges characterizes as a day when everyone did what was right in their own eyes. And he's going to say, here's what that looked like religiously, spiritually. Next week, in chapters 19 through 21, he's going to look at it from the moral corruption. What did that look like from the aspect of how the people have become corrupt morally? The first 16 chapters, we sort of moved chronologically through the Judges. These last five chapters aren't necessarily chronological in that they follow Samson. These are like excerpts from this entire period. And in these five chapters, the author is saying, here's what conditions looked like throughout that general period of the Judges. Here's what the spiritual religious climate looked like. Here's what the moral climate looked like. Here's what things looked like during this period of the Judges. Again, a period characterized by everyone doing what is right in their own eyes. What these stories teach us and what they show us, and this is pertinent because we're living in a period much like the Judges. Much like the Judges. It's a period when people have left God's directives. They've left a respect, a submission to, an obedience to, thus saith the Lord. And they are now doing what is right in their eyes. A verse which is repeated twice in these final five chapters, and which really is a verse that is the key to understanding the book of Judges. This verse appears word for word exactly in chapter 17, verse 6, as well as in chapter 21, verse 25. It says, in those days there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. This thought occurs in an abbreviated fashion twice more in these five chapters. In chapter 18, verse 1, as well as chapter 19, verse 1, it says, there was no king in Israel. It doesn't finish it, but it again is repeating that same thought. Now, what's involved in this statement that captures the essence or the characterization of this time period? It says, first of all, there was no king in Israel. The essence there is there was no absolute authority. Now, you stop and think. That's where we live today. If you believe in the absolutes of right and wrong, that there are absolute truth, you're in the minority. We live in a very pluralistic age, an age where there isn't an absolute. It's left up for everyone else to decide. Everyone to decide for themselves. That's the second part of this verse. Everyone did what was right in their own eyes. So there's no absolute authority. And individualism has been exalted as supreme. You know, you hear people say, my truth, that's what's right for me. That's what this is talking about. Everyone does what is right in his own eyes. You know, you will be harshly taken to task to challenge someone with absolute truth if it goes contrary to what is truth for them. So that's this period. That's this period, and that's us today. That's us today. Proverbs puts it this way, and this verse is repeated twice in Proverbs. There is a way that seems right to a man, but its end is the way of death. So in these final five chapters, we're going to look at two episodes. Mike and the Danites and the Levite and his concubine. Mike and the Danites is going to picture for us, illustrate for us that what the religious climate, the religious conditions were during this time period. And next week we'll look at the Levite and his concubine and we'll see what the moral climate was. But let's start today. Let's ask the question, what's the impact upon a society, spiritually, religiously, when they reach the point where everyone does what is right in their own eyes? What does that look like? We're going to see that there are three really spin-off byproducts, characteristics, if you will, religiously, spiritually, when that is true. In verses 1 to 6, we're going to see one of the characteristics is self-made religion. Self-made religion, and we'll look and see what that is. Then in verses 7 to 13, we're going to see self-seeking service as we examine this Levite. And then thirdly, when we come to chapter 18, we're going to see a self-accommodating lifestyle as we look at the Danites and what happens there. But let's, first of all, let's look at self-made religion, verses 1 to 6 here in chapter 17. It starts out, "Now there was a man from the mountains of Ephraim whose name was Micah." Now who is this Micah? What's true of him? Well, we learn a little bit about his home life from a start. He's from a wealthy family. Speaks to the fact here that his mother had dedicated 1,100 shekels of silver, she says, to the Lord for her son to make a carved image. And we'll talk about that in a minute. But it's indicative of the fact this is a wealthy family. We know that from the fact that later when this Levite is hired by Micah, he says, "I'll give you a salary, 10 shekels a year." Well, you do the math, that's over 100 years' salary by what this priest was getting paid. And this was sort of excess to the family budget. So this was a wealthy family. We discover from the interaction between Micah and his mother evidently lives in the home, which was typical of Jewish extended family. So this is sort of the home life setting. What about Micah's character? Well, we learn straight away he's a thief. He had stolen what was literally a small fortune from his mother. He's a thief. He's a thief with no conscience. It's not his conscience that eats away at him that eventually causes him to come to his mother and say, "I stole it." No, we gather from what he says, he hears that his mother pronounces a curse upon the thief who stole the money. He's a little bit superstitious. His conscience has not convicted him, but his superstition of falling under this curse his mother pronounced, that gets to him. So he comes back to his mother and says, "The money's with me. I stole it." He's afraid of this curse that his mother pronounced. Another thing we learn here, Micah really lacks parental discipline and guidance. When his mother uttered the curse, Micah's mother was unaware that it was her son who was the thief. And interestingly enough, when she finds out that it's her son who is the thief, she seeks to cancel out the curse by pronouncing a blessing upon him. She turns right, flip-flops, turns right around and says, "The Lord bless you, my son." Now what's obviously lacking here in this incident is there's no correction, there's no instruction from Micah's mother. You see no condemnation, no correction of Micah's mother to him that he stole a small fortune from his mother. No correction at all. You know, I found that tremendously instructive that because, you know, there's a lot of Christian parents who say they believe in biblical discipline and guidance for their children. But when it comes to their children, how far they fall short from what they say they believe. And you know, it's sort of an example of a child-centered parenting, and that's what we're seeing here with Micah's mother. She thinks she's a godly mother serving the Lord, wants best what's for her son. Yet she fails to discipline them and ultimately leads him into full-fledged idolatry. It's a case here of a dishonest mother raising a dishonest son. You say, why a dishonest mother? Well, in her, by her own words, she said, I had wholly dedicated the 1,100 shekels of silver to the Lord. And when it comes time, she gives it back and she's going to have the founder make the idol. How much does she give back? 200. It's like, okay, where's the other 900 you dedicated to the Lord? Where's that? That sort of got tucked away back into the mom's fund. A dishonest mother, and she's raising a dishonest son. What about Micah's future spiritual life and worship? You got a home here where together, mother and son, together they break at least half of the Ten Commandments, and seemingly no guilt. You know, they're praising the Lord. We're serving the Lord. I've dedicated... You know, think about the stupidity of the statement. I have dedicated the silver from my hand to the Lord to make a carved image. That'd be almost like saying I gave my tithe to the church so they could go buy pornography and spread it around. That's absurd. You're violating, first of all, the first and second commandment. No other gods before me, thou shalt not make a graven image. And yet you're doing it in the name of saying I'm serving the Lord. So they violated those two. Micah stole, thou shalt not steal. Before he stole, he coveted, thou shalt not covet. He did it to his mother. That's hardly honoring your father and mother. So they've broken half of the Ten Commandments here, at least. And yet, no consciousness of it. There's no sense of guilt or wrong. They actually think they're serving God. It's a little bit hard to get your head around, really. And he, even their own words... You know, Micah later, when his gods are taken away by the Danites, he says to them, you've taken the gods I made. It's like, okay, now how does that connect with the second commandment, not to make a graven image? You just admitted it. You just admitted it by your own words. You know, it's showing us the depth of spiritual delusion. When you leave the absolutes of God's directives, the depth of delusion you can go into. And that's where we see Micah and his mother. You know, does she, and we scratch our head, is this unknowing? There doesn't seem to be a conscious awareness of violation of God's directives. But she leads them into full-fledged idolatry. He establishes a shrine in his home, complete with a priestly garment, that's the ephod, a molten image, that's an idol of poured silver, a graven image, that's a carved idol coated with silver, and a number of portable household gods, which are called teraphim. Again, there's direct violation of God's commands, directives. Not only are the first and second commandments violated, as well as at least three others, there's a direct contradiction to God's command that worship was only to be carried out at the tabernacle. That was God's ordained, appointed place of worship. We won't take the time, but if you want to, turn to Deuteronomy 12, verses 4 and 5, as well as 10 to 14 later. God said, at the tabernacle, that's the appointed place. That's where you're to bring your sacrifice, your offerings. You're not just to do it anywhere. This is the appointed place. So he's violated that. We find out later, he consecrates one of his sons to be a priest. Well, the Lord had appointed that only from the family of Aaron were to be the priests. Not just the priests weren't just from anybody in the tribe of Levi. It was only from the line of Aaron. The Aaronic priesthood. That was God's appointment. That was God's plan. But here he feels the freedom to go ahead and make one of his sons a priest. Which later he has second thoughts, because when this Levite comes along, he thinks, oh yeah, this will make it more official. This is closer to being right. So he even subconsciously has an awareness that he's violating God's command as he does that. So Micah here has invented his own little religion. And it says it's in the hills of Ephraim. That's significant, because if you quickly looked at a map, you would find out that Shiloh, God's appointed place, is in the hills of Ephraim. Probably not far from Micah's house. So it wasn't a problem that it would be a long ways to travel to God's appointed place. No, it was actually close by. It was actually close by. And again, we see the spiritual delusion here. It was so thorough that he and his mother actually thought they were serving the Lord. We see in verse 3, where she says, I have wholly dedicated the silver from my hand to the Lord for my son to make a carved image. It's like, do you know what you're saying? The same with Micah. Look at verse 13. After he's made this Levite his priest, now I know that the Lord will be good to me since I have a Levite as priest. There seems to be this delusional self-assurance that, yeah, things are going to be great now. I'm serving the Lord. And he's a full-fledged idolater. Huge delusion here. That's ironic, because later, when he has this delusional satisfaction that everything's going to be all right, the next chapter, these idols and this priest that have brought him that satisfaction that everything's going to be all right are taken away from him. And he's upset and says, what more do I have? He's telling the devil, you took away everything I have religiously that I made. There's a lesson there. Some people think they've arranged their religious life and they're comfortable with it. And they think they're going to be all right. And yet if it's an idol, it can be taken away. It can be taken away. Let's apply this to us today. Now, our problem today is not carved idols. I doubt if any of you have any images at home set up in your house that you bow down to, etc. Our problem today is that we form mental pictures of God. How often have you heard someone say, I don't believe in a God like, and they proceed to describe God in some way. I like to think of God as, and then they give their depiction of what they think God is like. That is mental idolatry. You are making God out to be something that he is not. And we all do it. You know, we say, I don't like to think of a God who demands first place in my life, that he takes precedence above everything else. Okay, rewrite commandment 1. Thou shalt have no other gods before me. Well, I can't imagine God would be that demanding. Well, he is God. He is God. Isn't that a prerogative of being God? He is God. Oh, but I think God would be more understanding if I did this for myself. See, we want to remake God to fit our desires. And we do that mentally. But you see, our desires have nothing to do with God's true character. Quite frankly, does not make the slightest bit of difference what I prefer to think of God. God is who He is and what He is, no matter what I prefer to think of that. Human concepts of God are irrelevant. God has revealed Himself in His Word, and He demands that our understanding of Him conform to what He has revealed about Himself in His Word. And we become idol makers when we consciously and intellectually reject part of the scriptural revelation of God. We do this whenever we say, we can no longer accept a God who does this or a God who forbids that. When we use the term no longer, we wrap ourselves in a mantle of so-called progress. In fact, what we're really saying is our culture's distaste for this idea means that we must drop it. We must have a God that fits our cultural sensibilities. Now, it wasn't so many months ago I read an article by the vicar, who's no longer in our town, but was in our town, who said God had many forms of love, and it was a whole article about acceptance of same-sex marriage. And people reject God's directive and reformulate their idea of God around the philosophies that are acceptable to the present-day culture. When we do that, we're just like Micah's family. We're reshaping God to fit our society and hearts instead of letting God reshape our hearts and society. Now, we need to stop and ask ourselves as Christians, how biblical is our view of God? Is it formed according to what the Bible says? Or is it formed according to what latest preacher so-and-so or what talk radio? Or is it conformed to the philosophies of this age? You know, true Christianity is a faith that is a revealed faith. When I say a revealed faith, we draw it from the revealed truth of the Word of God. You know, otherwise, you're left in this wandering. You know, people are left to decide God is like what my experience and what my feelings tell me. Well, then what is God like? Because people's experiences and feelings are going to generate different ideas of God. And whose are you going to go with? Because this person's idea and feelings about God will differ from that person's ideas and feelings about God. And again, that's where you've left the absolute. There is no king. Everyone's doing what's right in his own eyes. Our faith is a revealed faith. God reveals Himself in His Word. We don't discover Him through our reason or experience. What God is saying is, worship me as I am, not as you want me to be. And worship me as my Word directs, not as your heart suggests. We're going to find out Micah was developing a religion that was convenient, that was comfortable, that worked for him. He follows the laws that he wants to and rejects those that he doesn't. You know, at one point he's appointing his son as a priest, and later he's like, oh, well, no, this would be more correct, so we'll stop that and we'll do this. We'll make this Levite priest. He doesn't have an absolute. He's just flowing with what feels comfortable at the time. And we're seeing this is what a society looks like when they do whatever they see fit religiously. You know, it doesn't have to mean a conscious rejection of God. Micah and his mother are still verbally saying, we're serving God. Nor does it require no longer calling on God or ceasing religious activity. They're still going through religious activity in the name of God. It meant that it was a religion on Micah's terms. This is the kind of religion I want. This is the kind I like. We're going to create an idea of God that's comfortable for me and lets me live the way I want to live. And that's where a huge portion of Christianity is today. You see, it's not a religion about God and His truth and His will. It's a religion about me and my ideas and my preferences. It's a religion which seeks to control and tame God, to remake Him in an image we're comfortable with. And so the first characteristic here is self-made religion. Let's move on. The next aspect we see is self-seeking service. Verse 7 starts out, "Now there was a young man from Bethlehem, Judah. He was a Levite." Now, let's look at this Levite. Give us some insight into what's happening here. And we're going to be talking about self-seeking service. The ministers, the Levite here, the preacher, if you will, during this time period. First, we see he was a wandering Levite. There's one phrase that's repeated twice here in these verses that tell us a great deal about this Levite. Verse 8 says, "The man departed from the city of Bethlehem, Judah, to stay wherever he could find a place." And then in verse 9, he says, "I am on my way to find a place." In other words, he set out from Bethlehem looking for a place to better himself. Probably the situation here is that during this period of spiritual religious corruption, the worship at Shiloh had fallen on such hard times. People were failing to go there to worship. They were bringing their tithes. He was probably no work. He's a preacher without a job. And so he sets out to go wherever he can find a place, make a living. He's not making a living in his due to the lack of spirituality and worship of the people of Israel. So it's probably a natural inclination here, except that in his case, it was totally contrary to the will of God. You see, the Levites were individuals who had the call of God upon their life to serve in the service of the Lord. And they were even appointed cities that they were to live in. You know, in the dividing up of the land, there were the Levitical cities that were appointed for the Levites. That was where they were to live and stay. And from there, they were to minister the surrounding area about them. There were appointed cities for them. It's interesting because it says he was from Bethlehem, Judah, which was not a Levite city. He's not even where he comes from. He's not even in the place where he should have been. But being a Levite, he had been assigned a specific task for his life, a specific place to live. If you want to look that up, Joshua 21, Numbers 35 talks about those Levite cities. But here was a man who refused to be satisfied with God's arrangements for his life. God had given him an area of service, but instead of faithfully serving in the sphere of his divine calling, he was committed to self-promotion and personal betterment. This is a dangerous thing. You find out when you read Numbers 16, another individual we read about there, Korah, who was a Levite. And Korah wanted to be a priest. He wasn't of the Aaronic line, but he wanted to be a priest. Read into that story. Moses said, God's going to judge this, and he's going to do it in an unusual way. If the ground opens up and swallows, and you go immediately into the pit, into the ground, then God has spoken, that's wrong. And that's exactly what happened. But here we find this Levite, he's feeling the freedom, not from the tribe of Aaron, to go ahead and accept a job as a priest. Another thing we find about not only was he a wandering Levite, he was a Levite for hire. Verse 10, Micah says to him, "Dwell with me, be a father and a priest to me, and I will give you 10 shekels of silver for per year, a suit of clothes and your sustenance. So the Levite went in. Then later in chapter 18, when the spies stop and question him, notice what he says, verse 4. Thus and so Micah did for him. He's saying, here's the provisions of the contract which I was employed by Micah. He has hired me, and I have become his priest. Preacher for hire. Preacher for hire. That's where we are today, too. Preachers for hire. They'll say what works for the people who pay their salary. You know, the number of preachers today that realize they're to be a spokesman for God. The responsibility upon their life to say, thus saith the Lord. Here you have a priest who's willing to say whatever gets him a job. And we're going to find that. That is true of him. That is true of him. He was a priest for hire. Now that's what happens when you get two men, both who have no principles when they get together. You see, Micah had some doubts about the legitimacy or the status of his little homemade religion. So he wanted a proper Levitical priest. This Levite, he needed a job and he needed a place to stay. And when the two of them get together, both of them ignoring God's directives, voila, you've got a solution. And there again, they're just following what's right in their own eyes, what seems practical. We're ignoring the directives of God. And you say, how do you know this was a preacher for hire? Because later when the Danites come along and they said, hey, look, what's better? Be a priest to just one family? You could be a priest to a whole tribe. He gets a better offer and says he gladly takes it. He gladly takes it. He's a priest for hire. He's a priest for hire. Then another thing, and I'll just mention this in passing, because you may notice this if you read your Bible carefully and if you, etc. This probably was a notable Levite. If you turn to chapter 18, verse 30, it says, then the children of Dan set up for themselves the carved image, and Jonathan, the son of Gershom, now he's been unnamed at this point, but now he's named. Jonathan, the son of Gershom, the son of Manasseh, and his sons were priests to the tribe of Dan until the day of the captivity of the land. Now, how many of you's Bible says son of Manasseh? How many say son of Moses? Okay, here's the story behind that. The Hebrew text reads, there's an irregularity here. When I say irregularity, when you look at ancient manuscripts, there's slight differences from one to the other in some. The Hebrew text has Moses, but it has one inserted letter that's raised slightly above the text line of the rest. Now, in Hebrew, Hebrew is a difficult language from the standpoint. If you looked at a Hebrew script of the Old Testament, a Hebrew document, old one, they only write their consonants. Best way to illustrate that for you, how many have seen specialized plates where they say a word, but due to the limited number of letters, they leave out the vowels? That's the way Hebrew is. The vowel pointing, which is the points underneath the letters, was added later. If you travel to Israel, and if you could read Hebrew, what you see on the signs is just the consonants. So the consonants were M, S, H, and an N was added that was raised just slightly. And I'm not going to debate with you. Some feel like it was part of the original. Some don't. That's why some of the conservative translations, if you've got NIV, ESV, or Amplified, it'll say Moses. The Vulgate and the Septuagint, which is the Greek translation of the Old Testament, they follow Moses. If you've got King James or New King James, they follow the raised N and have Manasseh. Why this insertion? Well, the early Jewish scribes were so embarrassed by this. Why were they embarrassed by it? Well, who is Gershom? Gershom was the son of Moses. The embarrassment is that the legacy of the great lawgiver Moses, that he would have what's a grandson or a great-grandson who's an out-and-out idolater. That's hard to deal with. So whether it was added or not, that's the reason behind why some say Manasseh, some say Moses. Some of the early scribes just could not accept the fact that this would be a great-grandson of Moses who's doing this. So the potential is this was a significant Levite, a descendant of Moses himself. Now let's quickly, we're about out of time. Chapter 18 starts out, "In those days there was no king in Israel, and in those days the tribe of the Danites was seeking an inheritance for itself to dwell in. For until that day, their inheritance among the tribes of Israel had not fallen to them." Now we stop and ask the question, why was the tribe of Dan seeking an inheritance for itself? We read later in the story, the seeking of an inheritance leads to sending out spies, eventually traveling far to the north. It speaks of the town of Laish, which is far to the north, outside of all the other inheritances of the tribes of Israel. And of eventually killing the inhabitants of that city and taking the city for themselves. Well, when we read that they were seeking an inheritance for itself to dwell in, we're not to think that God had somehow failed them or that Dan had been omitted when Joshua divided up the land. If we had time, we could turn back to Joshua chapter 19. And there it describes what was the assigned portion for Dan, which was down just west, northwest from Jerusalem, spreading northwest toward the Mediterranean Sea. That was the area that was prescribed for them. But we learn from Judges chapter 1 that Dan had refused to trust God by driving out the Amorites. Chapter 1, verse 34 said the Amorites had driven them up into the hill country. Probably they were reduced to living in just two towns. The previous judge we had dealt with, Samson, was from the tribe of Dan. It says his home was Zorah and Eshtaol. That's the area of the Danites. You think, you know, what an opportunity for this tribe with a Samson to have driven out the Amorites, to have driven out the Philistines and taken what was to the west was the flat, fertile plains where they could grow crops. And that's what the Amorites refused to let them have. But with a Samson, they could have conquered that. They could have done. But in their disbelief and their disobedience, they send out spies who eventually wander far to the north, and they find these people. The city of Laish, which you read the description the spies give, they say it's a good land, it lacks nothing. But the second description is, they're far from any help, they have no ties, it'll be an easy take. It'll be an easy take. And you see the logic. You know, why fight difficult Philistines and Amorites when there's a city up here that's easy pickings? We can take that easy, and it's good. You know, we see a case here where bad decisions of disbelief and disobedience are compounded. And first bad decision, we can't beat Philistines and Amorites. A lack of faith. Compounded with a second bad decision, there's this city up here, and it's easier. So let's go there. What ultimately happens? Yeah, they do. They go take it. It says they rename it after their father, Dan, and it's called Dan. Now, what's significant in the future of Dan? It becomes a major idolatrous center. Later, when the kingdom is divided and Jeroboam sets up his two calves for the northern kingdom to worship rather than going down to Judah and thinking that they would turn back to the southern kingdom. So he sets up two golden calves to worship. And where's one of them at? Dan. It's in Dan. It becomes a major idolatrous center. So they made a bad decision. What's another thing they do here? You know, bad decisions, you feel better about them if they've got a preacher's confirmation. Yeah, there's some people that will wander from church to church to church till they finally find a preacher that will agree with them that what wrong they're wanting to do, oh yeah, that's okay. So what do? When the spies are going, they pass through, they overnight, if you will, camp near Micah's house, and they discover that there's this Levite, this priest there. And so they ask the priest, will our journey be prosperous? And he said, oh yeah, God, the Lord will bless you. Now stop and think for a minute. A priest that has just told you, I'm a priest for hire, how confident are you going to be that you're going to hear from the Lord from that kind of man? He just explained to him, I came here, this guy's offered me a salary and sustenance, place to live, clothing, salary, and I've become a priest to him. Would you really think you're going to get truth from this preacher for hire? Well, he says, you know, Lord, go and bless you. You know, he tells them what they want to hear. They go, spy, come back, tell the Danites, yeah, it's a good place, it's easy to take. And they get their soldiers and a big portion of the tribe together to go up there to take it. Well, when they pass through the same place where they camped before, they stop again. And the spies tell the soldiers, now this house, it's got the works. It's set up for religion. It's got the aisles, the priests, I mean, the whole package is here. Now consider what you should do. It's like, here's another easy one for the taking. we're going to get the city, we'll get the complete religious package to carry with us. And when they appeal, first they go in and they just take them. You read carefully the setting here. There's 600 soldiers at the gate. And the spies go in and take the gods. And then the priest says, whoa, what are you doing? And they say, you best be quiet. There's 600 soldiers at the gate. Besides, come be a priest to us. Better offer. And it says he gladly accepts. And they take it and they go conquer Laish, establish their city, and settle there. So they found a comfortable living, an easy place to take, and a preacher who won't say a word against it. That's where a lot of Christian people are today. A preacher that will still preach against sin, that will call people back to God is first. No other gods before me. That doesn't sit comfortably with my lifestyle, particularly if there's still some idols in my life. So what do? They go find a church that won't say anything against them. A preacher that won't preach that. So they can carry on in their idolatry. And yet they have a preacher. They have a religious form. They have a religious exercise. But not one that will speak against the sin, the idolatry in their life. And so they're able to live comfortably, still thinking, just like Micah, oh, we'll be right. We're still serving God. We're still calling on the name of the Lord. I mean, we're doing it with idols, but hey, we're still calling on the name of the Lord. There's another principle here, and we'll close with this. The consequences of bad decisions aren't always immediate. And Micah said when he hired that Levite, "The Lord's going to bless me now." But it wasn't long after. Everything he had made and the priest he had consecrated, gone. And he was left saying, "I don't have anything anymore." Same true with these Danites. They thought they had finally found a comfortable inheritance in the north, and in the process had acquired a system of worship complete with images and priests. And then there's a little phrase that occurs at the end of chapter 18 that is real telling. Look at verse 30. It says, "Then the children of Dan set up for themselves the carved image, and Jonathan, the son of Gershom, the son of Manasseh, and his sons were priests to the tribe of Dan until the day of the captivity of the land." Eventually, the northern kingdom went into captivity to Assyria. And what was the reason God said why? It's your idolatry. Your idolatry. Yeah, there was a period where everything looked fine and great. But the consequences of idolatry caught up with them and they went into captivity. So yes, there will be people who structure their religious worship so they have a preacher, they have a church that won't interfere and speak against the idols, the sin in their life. And it may work fine for a while. Until the day of the captivity. Be sure your sin will find you out. This is religious corruption in Israel. A period when there was no king. There was no absolute authority. People had lost a respect for "thus saith the Lord." That is evident. Break half the Ten Commandments and not even feel conscious of it. And everyone did what was right in their own eyes. Oh, they hadn't stopped calling on God. They hadn't stopped religious activity. They were just doing it according to their preferences, according to what was right in their eyes, ignoring God's directives. This is not just ancient Jewish history. This is Christianity today. Let's bow in prayer as we close.